Good evening. Welcome to Behind the News for February 2nd, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And two interviews up for tonight. In a little bit, we'll speak with Isaac Shapiro of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities about, several things. Some new Congressional Budget Office data on the distribution of wealth and income from investments. Some of the president's claims about the economy and his proposals in the State of the Union. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Steve Kretzmann, who is with the think tank The Price of Oil in Washington, D.C. And I was quite stunned to hear George Bush. I couldn't bear to watch the address myself because I can't stand to watch the guy. But I did read the accounts afterwards that George Bush says the America is addicted to oil, which I think is exactly the same phrasing that the man his father called Ozone Man, Al Gore, used in his book Earth in the Balance back in the late 1980s. I'm not sure if I'd use that word myself, but it's a little more complicated than an addiction behavior. But in any case, for the president to talk about reducing oil, to paraphrase John Kennedy, is like L'Osservatore Romano denying the virgin birth. So what is up with that? We'll ask Steve Kretzmann that question at the bottom of the hour. Before we get to these compelling topics, we review the economic headlines this morning. Big news for data geeks, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reporting that productivity in the fourth quarter of last year, down 0.6%, a surprise to everyone. Most analysts are expecting a small increase. That's the first decline since 2001. Now, what does this mean? Productivity, conceptually, is simple enough. It's how much stuff you can produce in an hour of labor. But measuring that stuff, describing that stuff, is not quite so straightforward. What, for example, is the output of the financial sector? How do you measure the output of computers? Yeah, computers are doubling in speed every year or two, but does that mean the real value of a computer is doubling every year or two? Or if you're just doing word processing and email, have things changed all that much over the last 5 years? Lots and lots of conceptual and practical difficulties in measuring productivity, but it was down in the fourth quarter of last year, and that means that from the point of view of employers, their cost of producing stuff is going up. That's what really matters from the point of view of the owners and managers of the system, and they don't like it when that happens. So far in the economic expansion of the last 4 years, we've seen very, very strong growth in productivity. Again, I'm not quite sure how seriously we should take the numbers literally, but it is true that the value of output has been going up while wages and employment have not been going up. That's been very, very good news for corporate profits, which have grown very, very spectacularly doing this over the last several years. Most people taking this fall in productivity is just a one-off anomaly. We shall see. But we had a tremendous run in the productivity figures starting at about 1995 and continuing without interruption, pretty much without interruption, for the last 10 years. One little interruption in 2001, and again last quarter. Does this mean anything? Is the great boom in profits over? We shall see. The fundamental characteristic of this economic expansion, that is, profits rising very rapidly and wages and employment not rising very much at all, has been continuing. Are things about to change? We shall see. Some sign that the labor market is picking up this morning, Labor Department reporting that initial claims for unemployment insurance, people who've lost their jobs and sign up for unemployment insurance benefits last week, down 11,000, considerably below what people are expecting. I mentioned a few weeks ago when this number really started falling sharply, that there might have been some problems adjusting for the Martin Luther King holiday. That seems not to be what's causing this. It does seem to be some kind of genuine decline in layoffs, at least. Whether the pace of hiring is picking up, that we do not know. Tomorrow morning, the Labor Department will report on what happened in the job market in the month of January. I'm expecting a decent-sized gain, maybe 200,000 jobs, which is good, not spectacular, Better than we saw in the last part of last year, though. But some of that may be boosted by warm weather in January, which kept the construction industry going. But in any case, this is showing some improvement in the state of the labor market. And that partly, largely responsible for the increase in consumer confidence reported by the Conference Board the other day. The most outstanding feature of that report, the percentage of respondents describing jobs as plentiful, rising from 23% to almost 27%, a very sharp increase, and the share of those describing jobs as hard to get, falling from 22% to 20%. So, at least one month by this measure, looks like the job market is picking up. It could just be a matter of perception. It could just be noise. But we'll see in the coming months if there's anything happening here. But that is certainly a bright spot in what has not been a very bright labor market. The ABC Washington Post Consumer Comfort Index, that a weekly measure in contrast to the Conference Board's monthly measure, stable last week after several weeks of recovering from the drop-off at the end of last year. So it's a mediocre number, not a sort of in the middle ground, not great, not bad, but it does show that at least things are not falling apart. The Mortgage Bankers Association reporting a slight decrease last week in demand for mortgages. So the idea that the housing market, the great housing bubble that has dominated the economic scene for the last several years, as I've been saying, may be running out of steam, may be losing some air, and the Mortgage Bankers Association's mortgage tallies suggesting that that trend may be underway, but I think this is going to take a really long time to play itself out, and we shall see in coming months just how this plays out. But I think that housing, which has been really the driving force in the economy over the last several years, people borrowing enormous amounts of money against the appreciated value of their houses and spending that money, responsible by some estimates for about half the growth in the economy over the last several years. So important stuff. If the job market is struggling, then if the housing boom runs out of steam, then it's hard to see what's going to continue to keep the wheels of consumption spinning. And that's, of course, what it's all about in the United States. And then finally, the Institute for Supply Management, which is considered the trade association for purchasing managers, the people who buy things for corporations and presumably are in very good touch with the state of business at their employers. That falling in the month of January, a little weaker than expected, still positive, still suggesting an expanding manufacturing sector, but a disappointing number and continuing a trend of decline we've seen for now four consecutive months. And the employment component of that index also falling. So it's, once again, after a little pickup in the factory sector in at least factory jobs over the last couple of months, that does seem to be falling back. And we've lost something like 3 million manufacturing jobs over the last several years. So this is a very important reason for why the job market has been so disappointing over the last several years. Some signs of life picking up towards the end of last year, but now it does seem to be fading back again. So let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with Isaac Shapiro. And a little bit of the Felix the House Cat remix of Money, Success, Fame, and Glamour. And that's what does seem to be the U.S. economy has been all about. Not so much for the rest of us, but lots for the Money, Success, Fame, and Glamour portion of the the money, success, fame, glamour, demographic, let's call them. And now we're joined on the line by Isaac Shapiro, who's with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Welcome to WBAI, Isaac Shapiro.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
So a couple things I wanted to go over with. First of all, you came out with a report recently looking at some Congressional Budget Office data on the distribution of capital income, which is a fancy way of saying income from investments like interest and dividends and rents, showing tremendous increase in concentration. So tell us the story there.
Right. And I should say it also includes the largest component of capital income, not surprisingly. It's actually capital gains from stock investments. And what this data show, and it's data from the Congressional Budget Office, which is sort of the main source of budget and economic information for Congress, is that the capital income generally defined that is subject to taxation has become increasingly concentrated among the top 1% of the population, whereas around 1980, 1990, only about 40% or well less than half of capital income was received by the top 1% of the population. Now well over half of capital income subject to taxation is received by the top 1% of the population. Sounds like a lot of economic gobbledygook, perhaps, but what it translates to is very important for a decision that's before Congress right now, which is they're talking about extending a tax cuts on capital gains and dividend income. What the CBO data shows is that even more than had been generally understood, the benefits of such a tax cut would go overwhelmingly to high-income people and would occur at the same time as, in fact, just today, that Congress passed spending cuts in the names of deficit reduction that'll hit low-income people hard.
Yeah, I think several people have pointed out that we're giving tax cuts to the very richest in order to and funding part of those tax cuts in part by cutting aid to the very poorest. That's really not an exaggeration, is it?
You know, it sounds almost so implausible, and that people do feel you're exaggerating, and I'm exaggerating when I say that. But that in fact is the reality of the decisions Congress is making at the president's behest right now. In fact, the size of the tax cuts, the new tax cuts that are being enacted, are larger than the spending cuts that have been enacted. So not a dime of those spending reductions are going to be going to reducing the deficit. They're all going to pay for the tax cuts.
Let's stay with the concentration of capital income for a moment before we get on to the Bush economy and the Bush policy proposals. Why is capital income getting so concentrated? The ownership of capital assets has always been very concentrated throughout history, but why is it getting more so?
I do not have a complete answer. And having just found this data, in fact, last week, we've spent some time trying to sort out what's really going on here, and we've only come up with some theories and no real answers at this point. Certainly, one theory is that it's become more concentrated as, for example, CEO stock plans, the types of stock benefits going to CEOs. Are enormous, so they're reaping large gains from capital income. So that might have resulted in some increased concentration. Another factor that might be involved is that certain tax savings vehicles that can be used by both the middle class and upper income people, that middle class people really can't tend not to save very much. They can't afford to save very much. But what they can save is already in tax exempt retirement accounts, by and large. So when it comes to actual capital income subject to taxation, that would be increasingly concentrated among upper-income people.
Well, how does it fit with the president's talk about creating an ownership society? We certainly have some people who are owning a lot of stuff, but it's not really been spreading out very democratically, has it?
No, I mean, you do have a fairly large proportion of the population own some stock. However, that doesn't mean that at the same time that the actual extent of stock ownership is really widely distributed. As you noted just a minute ago, stocks and capital income are very concentrated among upper-income people. So if you enact a policy that might help a few middle-class people and might save them $100, it's going to save thousands of dollars for many more high-income people.
And just to put some numbers in this for the audience, 2003, the most recent data we have here, 57.5% of all capital income went to the richest 1% of the population, and 73% went to the richest 5% of the population. So there's not much left for the bottom 95% to work with there, is there? Let's talk a little bit about what the president has been saying about the economy and what he said in the State of the Union. He has... claiming that the economy entered 2006 with a full head of steam. Is that the way you see it?
Well, employment, jobs are increasing and increased at a decent rate in 2005, which is good news. Unfortunately, it's really the first really solid year of job expansion that we've had in a four-year recovery period, which is part of the bad news. You also have had reasonable economic growth over the last couple of years, so that slowed down in the last quarter, and we'll see if that was a result primarily of the hurricanes, so that's a temporary blip, or something more ominous. So there are some positive aspects to this economy. Underneath that, though, there's unfortunately several negative aspects. One is that wages are growing more slowly than inflation for most workers. So that means most workers lost ground in 2005. They didn't really gain ground. And if you look at the recovery period as a whole, it's been a pretty tepid recovery. We've compared this recovery to every other recovery since the end of World War II, and we found that there's really only one metric by which this recovery compares favorably to previous recoveries, and that's in the corporate profit areas. Corporate profits have boomed quite rapidly during this recovery, much faster than in the typical recovery. But if you look at anything from investments in capital investments to wages to job growth to income growth and all these other areas, this recovery compares unfavorably to previous recoveries. So things are not going gangbusters. They aren't going horribly, but gangbusters is not the right description.
Yeah, I actually just ran these numbers myself the other day. Profits in this expansion up more than 80% over the last 4 years or so, and the wages that corporations pay their workers up under 20%. So profits up more than four times as much as wages. The previous averages have been more like 1.5 to 2 times. So this discrepancy.
Those wage figures, by the way, include wages for the executives within the corporation. And I note that because the wages of middle-class workers and low-income workers have actually been falling relative to inflation since 2003.
So this is really a fat cat economy. It's not just irresponsible rhetoric to say that. The president is also talking about his party was once the party of balanced budgets and fiscal rectitude, and now they like predecessor in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan, created big deficits. Now the president is talking about being on track to get that deficit back under control. Do you buy that?
Well, he's been saying that for several years now, that pretty soon we're going to get it under control. Meanwhile, another negative feature of this recovery is that this stage of a recovery, to have as large a deficit as we have now, is not good news. It doesn't put us in good shape for if we do have another downturn, and which actually will strain fiscal finances even more. It has the effect of drying up investments because of so much money is needed to finance government debt. So the large deficit today, sort of after 4 years of a recovery, is a really unfortunate development in terms of the future of the economy. And I should say that if you look at the deficit this year, if you look at the deficit next year, you would have almost no deficit if the tax cuts that were enacted in 2001 and 2003 were not in place, the size of the overall deficit is only slightly larger than the size of the tax cuts that have occurred. And those tax cuts have been of primary benefit to high-income people. So the tax cuts have been a main reason why we're in the fiscal straitjacket that we are right now.
A lot of people think deficits are an abstraction. We really shouldn't worry about them. It's only old-fashioned central banker types that worry about deficits. Why should we care?
Well, ultimately, that money is paid back. It's paid back one way or another. It can be paid back through cutting back in government programs, and it's part of the pressure that did lead to the cuts enacted today in programs like Medicaid and child support enforcement and basic cash assistance was due to the fact that there is a deficit in at least at one level, though not all levels, members of Congress profess concern about that. But it does, in the end, that money has to be paid back, and that's part of the problem. And it also, as I mentioned before, if money is being used to finance the government's deficit, then that makes less savings available to finance private sector investment. So that weakens the economy in the long term.
I'm speaking with Isaac Shapiro. He's with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C. And you mentioned a couple of times now that they're talking about more tax cuts. We've already had several rounds of tax cuts in the last 3 or 4 years. Are we getting more?
Yes. In part, what the president both proposed new tax cuts in his speech last night and the other day, but he also proposed to make the tax cuts that were enacted in 2001 and 2003 permanent. At the time those tax cuts were enacted, there was concern that they were too large and that they would increase the deficit too much over time. So rather than to cut back, actually trim back the structure of the tax cuts, they just enacted them for a few years so they could say, oh, we didn't spend more than X amount on this. And it was actually fiscal chicanery because now they're coming back and says, oh, no, we can't let these things expire. We have to extend them on into the future, otherwise you'll have a tax increase. The appropriate way, if you are going to do a tax cut, is to do tax cuts and make them permanent. Understand what the true cost is up front and be willing to pay that true cost up front. Instead, we've been sort of playing the shell game where they keep on where one tax cut expires this year, another tax cut expires the next year, and so there's this ongoing battle over extending the tax cuts.
Well, that seems to be the way the administration does business. They're not, you'd say, straightforward with the public, always, are they? Now, one of the big centerpieces of the president's State of the Union, which I couldn't bear to watch, but according to what I read, he's talking about expanding health savings accounts. What's that all about?
Well, actually, when I was referring to new tax cuts, that's in part what I was referring to. There are several aspects to his health proposals, but primarily the health savings accounts, which allow people to put in money tax-free into a pot of money that could be used to spend on health care expenses and to withdraw that money tax-free, but could also lead to people, in essence, sheltering their investment income in these accounts as opposed to other accounts. It's primarily high-income people who are in a position that they could afford to use such accounts. So it's a way that primarily would benefit high-income people in terms of making it easier for them to pay for health care costs, but it would do very little if to help low- and middle-income people pick up their share of the health care burden.
Yeah, this would do basically nothing about the problem of the uninsured or even the people who are finding that their health insurance pays for less and they have to dig into their pockets for more and more of the expenses, right?
Yeah, I feel like it's a bit of a charade. I mean, there's huge concern in this country about the cost of health care. There's a huge problem with a large number of people being lacking insurance. So the president and the administration is pushed to have some type of response. So I think this is the response that they're trotting out, but I don't think it will either. It definitely won't help the pool of uninsured in this country. And for the large majority of the population, it won't do anything about trimming health care costs. So I don't think it's the answer.
But, of course, the financial services industry loves the idea of selling these things, right? Will this fly in Washington? I mean, will Congress pass this? Is this likely to be our health policy in the coming years?
There's definitely supporters within Congress, and I think it'll be a big battle this year. So far, these savings accounts have been put forward are in place in a limited way. There's some people who want to expand them. There's lots of other people who feel it's the wrong way to go. In the end, I think it will come down to whether or not people have a true understanding of who's really helped by these approaches and whether or not it gets at the core of the healthcare problems in this country.
And some of the estimates for how much this would cost, the tax deductions and such would cost the government are quite large, aren't they? This is not just pocket change.
No, and the long-term costs are actually quite large. If people, in the end, they take a tax deduction up front, that's some cost. But if in the end, over time, those costs build and build and build, and so not all of the costs will show up in sort of the official estimates that the government produces, so it actually makes it look like we're doing something and it won't cost very much, and that's just because the official government estimates only look at the costs in the first 5 or 10 years when most of the costs will be 10, 20, 30 years from now. So over time, the costs will be quite substantial.
Now, for those of us who are not in Washington, sometimes it seems like a weird and distant place, but it looks from this distance that the U.S. government is courting fiscal disaster, and you don't hear too much noise about that. Do people in Washington shrug their shoulders? What's the buzz around town?
Well, I think we are courting in the long term fiscal disaster, as you put it. I don't think that's an overstatement, and that's because, as we all know, the baby boom generation is about to retire. That's going to put enormous pressure on healthcare expenditures and other expenditures in this country. So our fiscal problems right now are quite serious, but they're about to get much worse. And in a way, this goes back to your question about why we should care about the deficit. And to me, it's a moral issue. And having just become the father of two young children, I do think about it in terms of my children, and I think about whether or not I think it's fair that right now I live in a country where, we're going along and having paying for things by adding up debts that my children and the listeners' children are going to have to pay. And I don't think that's the right way to approach government.
And my month-old child, too, as well.
Oh, congrats.
Thank you. And congrats to you, too. Thank you for joining us, Isaac Shapiro,
okay.
Who is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington. And you can read all these reports and much more at their website, cbpp.org, CBPP, as in Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.org. Let's take a little break, and we'll be back with the next
segment. Steve Brown, you're listening to WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
And that is, as the man said, this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org. And let's take a little musical break. Before we take a musical break, I forgot to mention at the top of the hour the momentous transition that we've just experienced, the end of the Greenspan era, 18 years. With Alan Greenspan at the head of the Federal Reserve, he left office on January 31st, succeeded on February 1st by Ben Bernanke, who was formerly an academic, an economist at Princeton University. Usually when Federal Reserve chairs, when there's a succession at the Fed, the new guy, and it's been a man every time when I say new guy, the new guy has to raise interest rates just to show how tough he is. So most people expect that the Fed is due for one more round of interest rate increases when it has its next meeting about 6 weeks from now. and the debate is whether that will continue. This morning's weak productivity numbers suggesting that maybe they will tighten up in order to get inflation down and really push the unemployment rate back up, not to put too fine a point on it, because they seem to be worried about labor costs rising, even though wages really are going nowhere. But this is how people in the financial elite think. But just a word or two about the end of the Greenspan era. He is the most overpraised guy I've ever come across. He is praised as the greatest genius who ever managed an economy, the greatest central banker of all time. Really, I want to... you got to wonder about that. Let's just a quick review of his record. Shortly after he took office in 1987, there was a dollar crisis, a stock market crash. Following that, there was the final stages of the debt mania of the 1980s, the leveraged buyouts and takeover mania. That collapsed around 1989, 1990, gave us 3 or 4 years of a really stagnant economy. When the economy finally recovered, it morphed into one of the great bubbles of all time, the stock market bubble, the dot-com mania, the NASDAQ idiocy. Along the way, though, there was a financial crisis in Mexico. There was a financial crisis in Southeast Asia. There was a financial crisis in Russia, all of which had very severe real-world effects. All of those regions that went into crisis experiencing deep recessions, and the Federal Reserve, at least part of that, the cause of that. Then after that, we had with the stock market bubble burst in 2000. Greenspan pushed down interest rates to record low levels, which unleashed a housing bubble, which is now appears to be coming to an end and may leave the U.S. economy with a big hangover of big mortgage debts and not enough income to service those debts. So if this is the greatest central banker of all time, I'd really hate to see the worst. So now let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with Steve Kretzmann. And that a piece of the hit of the Who's great anthem to environmental irresponsibility, Going Mobile. A nice introduction to this segment. We're joined by Steve Kretzmann, who is with, sorry, I forgot my biographical crib sheet. The Price of Oil is the organization?
It's Oil Change International.
Oil Change International.
But
okay.
The website is priceofoil.org.
Priceofoil.org. Okay. Well, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you very much.
I was stunned to read an account of the president's speech in which he declared that we're addicted to oil and he wanted to reduce our use of it. Since this is the president from the oil industry, heads an administration that practically looks like a branch of the oil industry, what's going on here? Should we take this seriously?
No, we really shouldn't, although I think you have to give a small amount of credit for acknowledging that there is a problem, which it's nice to actually hear that level of an acknowledgement. That said, just the day after he said that, which was yesterday, the Energy Secretary, Samuel Bodman, immediately said, well, the president didn't literally mean that, and basically took it all back. So it's pretty clear they are not at all serious about this. If you look at the details of what he's proposing, there it's really sort of window dressing and token increases in investments in alternative fuels and clean energy, the majority of which that he mentioned the other night actually doesn't do a darn thing about oil addiction because it actually goes for electricity production. Compare that to the $4 billion the oil industry just got in the energy bill that the administration very vocally lobbied for and helped pass in Congress. And you can see where the priorities still really are. I mean, at the end of the day, asking George Bush to be the one to tackle oil addiction is like asking Jack Abramoff to tackle corruption. It's not going to happen.
Well, you know, there's always the old Nixon and China model. Who'd warm up relations with China but the old anti-communist Richard Nixon? But it's not working that way with the old oil man George Bush, is it?
No.
Well, you just mentioned $4 billion in new tax breaks for the energy industry at a time when, last week, ExxonMobil reported $32, $34 billion profit last year.
36.
Oh,
yep.
Sorry, don't mean to insult them. And Shell, I think, reporting today $23 billion last year. What are these tax breaks supposed to do?
Oh, they're supposed to help them increase their finding of new oil and increase them bringing more oil to market.
And they haven't been doing very much of that, even though they've been making tons of money.
Well, this is the really interesting thing, right? Because this is sort of the writing on the wall behind the whole industry. And, at the end of the day, the real economic reason why we may have to end up tackling oil addiction sooner than George Bush and his friends would like to, which is that for the last 2.5 decades, the oil industry as a whole globally has been finding less oil than they have been delivering to market. Now, the oil majors, people like Exxon, BP, Shell, et cetera, have been avoiding this trend by cherry-picking the best fields around the world and by mergers and acquisitions swallowing up the smaller companies. But they're now reaching the point where they can't actually find that much more additional new fields to add into their reserves base. And they're starting to get nervous about it. And the way Congress has been dealing with it and the way the oil industry has been basically telling them to deal with it is throwing them more money and saying, just give us more money, we'll find more. Just give us more money and they'll find more. Well, they've been doing that now for the last 20 years, and it hasn't been working. So as if they even needed more money. So anyway.
Yeah, when you've got $36 billion in profit, right, you really don't need additional
right
tax subsidies to drill for oil. But our neighbors here on Wall Street are not too excited about the idea of the oil companies spending money on drilling rigs and such. They'd rather just distribute the money to the shareholders anyway. There were some the president did talk about reducing our reliance on Middle Eastern oil by, 20% or 25%? Of course, the Saudis didn't like the sound of that at all. They immediately protested. But what specific proposals did the Bush administration float, if any?
Well, this reduction of 75% by 2025 is interesting to unpack a little bit in and of itself, because the way currently only about 17% of our imports or 11% of our total oil consumption comes from the Persian Gulf on a daily basis. So really what they're saying right there is we are going to reduce by 8.4% our total oil consumption in the next 19 years, which, you go back to the addiction analogy and you don't tackle an addiction by saying, hey, I'll eliminate 1 in 10 drinks over the next 19 years. That's not really the way to do it. You need a plan to go all the way.
Well, oil consumption has been going up 1 or 2% a year, right, anyway, in the United States. So cutting it by that much seems... Well, we'd have to do a lot to meet even that modest goal, wouldn't we?
Well, it's interesting. It's not in terms of whether or not he is, whether or not they were thinking about 8.4% off of business as usual or 8.4% off of current levels. None of that's clear at all, right? And pretty much Energy Secretary Bodman yesterday has pretty much totally backed off this in a press conference. And he said that, A, we weren't talking about Mideast oil specifically, and now they're trying to calm the Saudis down, and B, we don't really know how we're going to do this. And they don't really have anything specific on the table. They are talking about ethanol, but they haven't really mapped out how they want to really go from here to there in terms of increased ethanol consumption.
But what about ethanol? That's sort of controversial. Some people saying that's a great alternative. Some others who say that it takes as much energy to produce as it releases when you use this stuff. So is ethanol a really good idea?
It can be. There are ways to do ethanol that definitely will get you more energy than you produce in the first place. I think the bigger problem is probably land use over time, because if both in terms of if we start planting up farms for ethanol crops, you're going to have competition for food crops, which has some rather dire implications over the long run, and also because there simply isn't enough land available to quench the thirst of the American driving habit. So there are some real implications there. There are some ways around it. There's new technologies called cellulosic ethanol, or ethanol really from waste, the waste part of the crop that doesn't go to food, which actually does promise a way forward. But it's still in early stages. But frankly, I think it is definitely part of the energy solution for the future.
Are there greenhouse gas issues with ethanol?
Not if it's done properly. As long as you're not sort of doing oil-intensive agriculture, it's actually a closed-loop system because the plants absorb CO2, and then it's released in burning, and so it's actually that's one of the beauties of using any kind of biofuel, is that it's closed loop in terms of CO2 emissions, and that's a great advantage.
I'm speaking with Steve Kretzmann, who is with Oil Change International, based in Washington, D.C., and the website, priceofoil.org. Now, the president also said something about the beauties of clean nuclear power. That's been kind of a bad word since Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, but is he trying to bring that one out of the crypt?
He's definitely trying to bring it out of the crypt, and actually there's been no nuclear plants ordered in the U.S. since Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, right? So it's more than it's a bad word to everyone, investors included. The nuclear industry has latched on to global warming, saying, hi, we're an emissions-free, global warming-free technology, and we can help get us out of this, this hole we're in for electricity production vis-a-vis global warming. But there's absolutely no, there's still absolutely no solution out there for the long-term storage of nuclear waste. And they have done a lot with their PR people in reframing these new technologies as quote-unquote inherently safe. The reality is it has been built. The record of the industry is nothing short of abysmal, and you couldn't really design a more expensive way to get energy if you tried. So,
I want to return to the alternatives issue at the end of this, but let's just talk a little bit more about oil. If we really were serious about reducing oil use, how would you go about it?
Well, I think that you've got to do a lot of things. There's some really promising technologies. Ethanol is part of the mix. Biodiesel is probably a part of the mix.
What's biodiesel?
Biodiesel is basically diesel made from soybean oil, right, and refined in a particular way. But it can also be made from waste grease, actually, from your local McDonald's. So there's a lot of potential sources of biodiesel. There's also plug-in hybrid technology, which I think is actually pretty promising for the future. At the end of the day, there are a million technologies out there that are potentially ready to take it up, and a lot of it's also going to involve changing, our infrastructure and our driving habits and our general lifestyle. And you can actually, if listeners are curious, there's a great website put up by Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute. It's called oilendgame.org. And I would commend anybody who has interest in technological issues to go there. But at the end of the day, what we think at Oil Change is that the barriers are really political, not technical at this point. You see all these technologies that are pretty much there, but the fact of the matter is the current political system, the current economic system, vastly favor the status quo, and particularly the oil industry, because of how deeply entrenched they are with this government. And so what we're calling for really is something we call a separation of oil and state at this stage. And we're asking politicians who are committed to reducing our fossil fuel addiction, in particular our oil addiction, to stand up and say, okay, I'm not going to take any more money, any more campaign contributions from the oil industry, and I'm going to chart a path forward from this point forward. So we're looking for good results from that campaign as a way of really bringing pressure.
Well, could we really seriously reduce oil consumption and continue to live as spread out as we do and drive around in big, fat vehicles like we do? Or will we have really to change pretty major aspects of our day-to-day life?
There will have to be some changes for sure. Certainly the driving big, fat vehicles thing is probably going to be right out. But that said, there are plenty of people out there who technically will tell you that that there are technologies, whether they're plug-in hybrids or whether they're biodiesel or whatever, that actually could make this much more sustainable for the long run. But you know, I think it's going to be a mix of technologies. There's a lot of discussion always about like what's the magic bullet technology, and there really isn't one, and that's one of the things that's hardest to get your head around about these technical issues. And I just think that really at the end of the day, the technical issues, they can be left to energy policy planners and transport policy planners. What we really need to do is stand up and demand the politics change, because I really demand that our representatives call for a clean energy future with some teeth in it and not the kind of empty rhetoric that we're seeing out of the president.
Now, it's funny that in a speech in which the president talked about boosting our R&D effort to stay competitive and reducing our use of oil, as the New York Times story on this pointed out this morning, the Energy Department will be laying off people at its alternative fuels R&D center because of budget cuts. So are they actually putting their money where their mouth is, or is this just a lot of rhetoric?
It's just mostly a lot of rhetoric. It's really the Bush administration has cut funding for R&D and for alternative fuels more than any other administration previously. I mean, they have been completely hostile to the idea of alternative energy. I mean, this is an administration pretty much of, by, and for the oil industry, and in some ways Exxon in particular.
Why do you say Exxon in particular?
Well, just because, really, I mean, you look at even the oil companies and Exxon's position on climate change is very clearly in lockstep with what the Bush administration has been saying.
Yeah, they're extreme even by the standards of the oil business, right?
Excuse me?
They're extreme even by the standards of the oil industry. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Exxon has been the bad boys of big oil, which is a pretty bad boy group to begin with, right? And so they continue to fund climate skeptics, you know, sort of junk science, scientists who run around saying, oh, there's no consensus on this problem, we don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, the reality is there is full consensus on the problem, and we have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen, and it's pretty bad, and we need action today. But, you know, people like Exxon pour millions and millions of dollars into, you know, PR campaigns and funding poor scientists to go around and sow the seeds of doubt. And they have certainly found fertile ground for those seeds to grow in the Bush administration.
There was a bizarre op-ed piece in the Financial Times the other week by somebody who's claiming that trees are really the problem with global warming. So I guess you can find people to make any kind of argument you want.
Yeah.
Well, we've got oil now, you know, in the mid-60s, $60 a barrel. It's quite high by the standards of what we got used to in the 1990s. It doesn't seem to have changed politics or behavior all that much. Is it just that people think it's a temporary thing, or is it just $67 not high enough? Or how do you read the relation between the price of oil and how much we use it?
I think it is changing politics and behavior. I mean, we just had a president stand up and say the nation is addicted to oil, which I'm not sure would have happened if oil prices were down in the 40s or the 30s. And I think, you know, additionally, you know, the hottest selling car in the United States today is the Toyota Prius. You look around at all the advertisements for cars, and all of a sudden everybody's touting their fuel efficiency and, you know, if they've got it, and trying to talk about it. Meanwhile, the American manufacturers, who are way behind on the curve of manufacturing efficient vehicles, have more cars on their lot than they can sell. So, you know, I think there is a shift going on, and I think that people do respond to the higher prices. That said, I think it's unfortunate that people have to pay a penalty at the pump for this kind of thing to happen while Exxon runs away with record profits. I mean, what we would really like to see is a windfall profits tax here that would fund alternative energy, that would fund affordable transport for low and middle income people, and really, you know, be able to you know, take the money out of where it should be taken out of, which is the corporate profits.
I would guess you're not getting a very warm reception in Congress for that kind of proposal.
Not particularly, no. But I think we would have been laughed out a year ago, and we've got people listening to us now. So that's a step forward.
So what do you see coming out of the administration? Will there be any follow-through on the president's rhetoric, is Bondman really letting the cat out of the bag by saying he didn't really mean what he said?
I think Bobman just lets it get out of the bag. I mean, I think the fact that the Saudis are, you know, publicly saying we look forward to hearing what they actually meant on that, and clearly rebuking the president for saying that. I mean, we're going to see, you know, how fast the Bush administration turns tail on this issue. I really doubt that it's going to amount to much. But that said, you know, it's telling that he used the word addiction, and it's certainly a word that we would agree applies in this case. And I think it's sort of a watershed moment for American understanding of the scale of the problem.
Yeah, I was very shocked to see that, particularly because that was the word that the man his father called Ozone Man used, right? Al Gore had a whole chapter in The Earth and the Balance all about our addiction to oil. It was very strange for Bush to pick up on that rhetoric. Is this you know, his recovery personality coming out, or it's hard to figure out what was behind this. And finally, whenever I have an oil expert on here, I like to ask where they stand on the peak oil question. Do you think, how far away are we from the peak in oil production in your view?
Well, you know, I think that we are, I think that this is a little bit of a canard, but I'll go into it with that said. I think that the reality is we're probably only 5 to 10 years away from global peak in oil production, and so it's closer than I think the U.S. government and most oil companies will publicly say it is. And if you look at the numbers, and if you look at if actually you look at our website, we have a section on peak oil with some presentations and breakdowns, which I find very compelling. But I also think that there are some, you know, there's a lot of heated rhetoric around peak oil, and I don't think that it means imminent societal collapse, as I have heard others argue at different times. I think it means hard times, and it means a transition is going to be required. But I don't think we need to head for the hills quite yet.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Steve Kretzmann. Steve Kretzmann is with Oil Change International, based in Washington, D.C., a website, priceofoil.org, and then at Amory Lovin's website he mentioned, Oil Endgame, all one word, oilendgame.org. Thank you for joining us, Steve Kretzmann.
Cheers. Thanks very much.
And I guess that's about it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. And I think I'll be back here next week with a semi-regular program interspersed with lots of pleas for funds. So please do get your dialing fingers ready and your Visa card or your checkbook ready pledge generously and frequently come next week. So let's go out with this new piece of music, relatively new piece of music from a band called Test Icicle. I learned this afternoon from a little instant web research that a test icicle is one that was used to see, they're testing it out to use as before you stab someone to see if it's a nice firm icicle that can pierce skin. And so that's what this band is all about. The song is called What's Your Damage? A bunch of young British punks with a semi-new sound. Test Icicles, What's Your Damage? Till next week. Bye.